50 in Concord and 60 in Portsmouth. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This summer, millions of American college students could feel their already heavy debt loads grow even heavier. Without action by Congress, the interest rate charged on federal student loans is set to double in July from 3.4% to 6.8%. In New Hampshire, that means 38,000 college students could take on an additional $30 million in debt. Everyone in Congress says they're working to avoid this, but the closest they may come is a one-year extension of the lower rate. As far as a more permanent fix goes, Democrats have their plan, Republicans have theirs. An agreement in this election year is unlikely. Still, many who study this issue of burgeoning student debt say the debate over loan rates is just a small part of a gigantic problem, which includes why higher education is so expensive in the first place and how much students and their families are responsible when they bite off more college than they can chew financially. Today in The Exchange, what's driving student debt? Let's hear from you. Why do you think American college debt now exceeds credit card debt? Is it the college's fault for ever-rising costs and tuition? What about students and their parents? Where, just as mortgages and credit cards, some may be spending beyond their means on higher education. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're on Facebook, too. Go to our page and post your thoughts there. Our guests include Tara Payne. She's Vice President of College Planning and Community Engagement for the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. And Tara, nice to see you. Welcome back to The
Thanks
Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Chicago, Sandy Baum, economist and senior fellow with the George Washington University Graduate School of Education and Human Development. She's written extensively on student debt, college access, and other aspects of higher education finance. And Sandy, a pleasure having you. Thanks for your time.
It's good to be here.
Also with us from D.C., Andrew Gillen, senior researcher for the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, a nonprofit organization that works on issues of affordability and academic standards in American higher education. And Andrew Gillen, good morning to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all three of you, there's been a lot of angst about this lately, given those numbers that I just mentioned. And Andrew Gillen, I think to you first, what do you think? Is this as big and as bad a problem as it's made out to be?
Yes and no. So the worst stories that you hear about are, of course, the kind of the worst case scenarios, so the students who have no job and, you know, insurmountable debt. But for the most part, most students who graduate from college are going to be able to service their debt. So it's not, I don't think it's a crisis necessarily, but there are certainly a lot of students out there in very tough situations.
So the macro numbers aren't as concerning as they sound, Andrew, the $1 trillion and the more than we owe on credit cards. When you break it down, you're saying it's not that bad?
Well, so it depends on the individual student. So my rule of thumb is don't borrow more than your expected starting salary. So that's going to be somewhere in the 20 to 30 range for most students. So if you're borrowing more than that, you're going to be in trouble.
What do you think, Sandy? What's the impact of this debt on the individual and more broadly on the nation as a whole?
Well, Andrew's right that it's not a general crisis. The problem is that there are some students and some particular categories of students who are borrowing more than they will be able to pay back. The aggregate numbers are pretty meaningless. I mean, there are more and more students going to college and therefore more and more students borrowing. And what matters is what individual students face. And going to college is an investment that pays off pretty well for most people. So it's totally reasonable to pay for it over time. It's just important to be cautious about how you borrow.
So more students going to college means more aggregate student debt. And that's good news then, Sandy.
Well, that's exactly right. We wouldn't want everyone to put college on their credit cards, and then credit card debt would be higher and student debt would be lower.
And we'll talk about the different types of student debt and some of the problems with some of those types of student debt. But, Tara, to you here in New Hampshire, how do you see these debt loads and these relatively high costs of higher education here in New Hampshire affecting the students and families that you work with?
Well, you know, I think the costs have risen and there are concern for families, but I think it's almost magnified by the lack of financial literacy that not only students, but also parents are coming to the table with, not understanding what it means to take out that debt obligation and that it does in fact have to be repaid. I think that when we saw some of the Occupy protests, we noticed that, one of the biggest issues was student loan burden and student loan debt. And I think that issue of consumption of a private or a federal student loan and then the fact that it needs to be repaid is something that these students didn't even understand or realize at the time that they took on the obligation.
And why didn't they realize it?
I don't know. What did we learn from the mortgage crisis? I don't know. But it seems that they didn't have the adequate education during their high school years related to personal finance. So, that's a big part of what we do, obviously, in our work through the Center for College Planning, where we go out and we talk to K-12 students about, as early as the second grade, spending, saving, and sharing, and what that means. And we carry that all the way through to their senior year of high school. But it just seems that I don't know if it's during their time at college, maybe they're not getting adequate financial literacy education so that they understand what that means at repayment. But that's one of the things that I think needs to be a big focus as we talk about globally what this means and as a problem for students when they graduate.
Well, and Tara, what about parents, though? I mean, many parents are involved in this college financing thing, too.
Parents are definitely more we'd call cost conscious. They definitely walk into our office. We had about 2,000 students and parents come into our office this year to fill out the financial aid forms, to get support with that, all for free. And as we're sitting down with them, you're hearing parents say right up front before they've even filed for financial aid, this is it. This is the most we're willing to do. This is the cap. So whatever happens, we'll give it a shot and we'll apply for financial aid. But at the end of the day, this is what we're willing and able to do.
What do you think, Andrew Gillen? Tara seems to be saying, some of the students are kind of clueless about these costs and how much they'll have to pay back.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you have to remember that in a lot of cases, these are 18-year-old students. This is kind of the first major financial decision they've made, and it's going to have repercussions for the rest of their life. And I don't think that the financial literacy of the typical 18-year-old is really where it needs to be to shoulder that kind of responsibility.
And what do you think, Sandy, about the idea that parents, some of them are putting caps on, but clearly all of them aren't putting caps on, or maybe you wouldn't see these levels of debt. What do you think about the parental role, Sandy?
Well, it is disturbing that parents are not wiser and more able to guide their children. We have to remember that a lot of college students who are borrowing the most money actually are adults, that a lot of students who rely on debt come from families where there really is no financial experience because there are low-income families. But there's also the problem that people just think the message that we give about college is sort of undifferentiated. We say, go to college, it's great, life will be great, and we don't actually give that much guidance about different colleges, about different things you can study, about your chances for success. And many institutions are not so scrupulous about giving good advice to people who want to enroll.
Now, that's interesting. Give us a little more on that, Sandy, sort of a for instance.
Well, for instance, students get lots of email messages from lenders, private lenders, that don't differentiate themselves so well from the federal government. It gives better loans from institutions, and this is primarily but not exclusively for-profit institutions who are advertising. And, of course, what they're doing is saying, buy our product. And you have to be a wise consumer in order to know how to respond intelligently to that sort of advertising.
So this gets into the different types of loans that students get as we talk about student debt. And Tara, as I understand, there's the federal student loans that I mentioned in the beginning,
yes,
guaranteed by the federal government, low interest rate, 3.4%.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's private loans, and those are different. How do those function differently?
Those are different. Private loans are offered by local lenders or national lenders as an alternative to the federal student loan program. And, for many years, we saw a huge increase in the number of students who were taking out private loans. And that's because they were so accessible, similar to so many of the mortgage products. They were so accessible. It was so easy to get them that we saw a lot of families heading in that direction, maybe even before they've applied for financial aid and received the grants and scholarships that they might be eligible for. So it was a huge concern. Today, private lending is We're not seeing that being as popular an option. You know, I think a lot of families, the federal government has done a good job. The U.S. Department of Education has done a good job in encouraging families to start with the federal program first. But you still see private loans being a concern because of the high interest rates or the variable interest rates. You know, for some families who have great credit, or for individuals who have great credit, a private loan could actually be in their favor because it might have a rate that's even lower than the federal government programs. For example, the parent loans right now are at 7.9% from the federal government. Now, that certainly does not reflect their cost of funds. In fact, you know, they're making money on parents who are borrowing for higher education. So a private lender who's able to come in and offer a product for a parent at a, you know, more reasonable marketplace rate of 4.5%, 5.5%, that might be the best bargain. But there was a time when the cost of funds was higher, when students were being targeted, not their parents. And so, you know, that's also, we've seen a shift in the last 5 years.
Interesting. Andrew Gillen, your thoughts there, too, the different types of financing and which ones may be better in terms of the students' overall debt.
Well, the rates that you're going to pay on the federal loans are so much better that you should definitely, If you're going to borrow for college, you should definitely be borrowing from the federal government until you've maxed out your loans from them. At that point, you really should be questioning if you've already maxed out your federal loans and you need to take out private loans. You really should be questioning if you should be going to that school and if you can afford to be going to that school. Because if you graduate with the maximum amount of federal loans, you're already going to be about at what you can afford to repay at graduation. So anything you borrow from the private lenders at that point is just going to be, digging a deeper hole for yourself.
And yet, Andrew, and I'm sure you know that this is, you know, you've seen this, it's hard to say to a kid, you know, you just got accepted to some terrific school, but no, you can't go.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to say no to that dream.
Yeah. Yeah, and that goes back to Sandy's point where we tell everybody to go to college, but we don't say, well, you know, go to this college if you can go for this much, or this college if you can go for that much. And so, to some extent, some of that advice might be useful.
All right. Well, we will talk more after a short break and start taking lots of your calls. So you can join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Your thoughts on college debt? Is it the huge problem that it's often made out to be? Or, as one of our guests said, just a necessary expense that you hope will pay off in the long run? We'll also get into why American higher education is so expensive, how that plays into the college debt issue. Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Franklin Pierce University, a leader in adult education, offering degrees from associate to doctorate. New term begins May 31st and June 20th. Information at franklinpierce.edu. And Hearing Solutions New England, where audiologists diagnose hearing loss and dispense hearing aids in Nashua, Manchester, Concord, and online at hearingsolutionsne.com. More on the student debt debacle on The Exchange on NHPR, and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein on the new politics of extremism. New Hampshire weather for today, clouding up, high temperatures 67 to 72 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, a chance of showers, lows from 45 to 50. For tomorrow, cloudy, breezy with showers, highs from 45 in the North Country, ranging to around 60 in southern areas of the state. And Wednesday, cloudy, showers ending, remaining breezy, high temperatures in the 60s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what's driving student debt? Let's hear from you. Why do you think American college debt now exceeds credit card debt? Is it the college's fault for ever-rising costs? What about students and their parents? Are some people spending beyond their means on higher education? Join us with your thoughts and comments, personal experiences with this issue at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're on Facebook, too. Go to our page. Post your thoughts there. Sandy Baum, I want to go to you first on this fundamental issue, but hear from everybody. A lot of people say, look, students wouldn't be racking up so much debt if college weren't so outrageously expensive. What do you think?
Well, there are a couple of issues here. One is that in New Hampshire, the price, the published price of four-year public colleges and also of community colleges is higher than anywhere else in the country.
Right. We're number one in terms of student debt. Yes.
Right. Anything you look at, but student debt, the price of college.
Yes.
The tuition is higher. The state subsidizes its public institutions less than any other state in the country, and it does not provide any significant amount of grant aid to its students. So those things combined mean the taxpayers are not paying for higher education. Somebody has to pay for it. And so in New Hampshire, it's the students and families who pay for it. The story is very different in some different states, in many states across the country. New Hampshire is really extreme. So it's not a surprise that New Hampshire students borrow more than others. It is expensive to provide higher education. People think it's expensive because it's got a high price tag and it's been going up rapidly, partly because there's less money coming from governments. Colleges and universities do need to figure out ways to teach in more economical ways, and people are working on that in terms of technology. But the fact is that many cost-saving measures really reduce the quality of education, so it's not so simple. If you look at other things that people buy that really depend on people and the services of people, not on more efficient machinery, you see their prices going up very rapidly as well. Look at dentists, look at theater tickets. There are a lot of things like that. So it's going to go up faster than the average price, but colleges and universities do need to figure out ways to be more efficient. But that's not going to make college free or cheap.
No, and I'm not expecting free or cheap, but boy, you do hear around the country, Sandy, people saying more and more, look, colleges, you need to do something about this. In his State of the Union address, President Obama directly said, colleges and universities, don't do it. Stop raising the tuition. So it seems like these days there is a lot of pressure on the universities themselves to lower costs.
There's a lot of pressure, but that doesn't mean that the reason is because colleges and universities are doing a lot of things wrong. One thing that's very important to note is that the sticker price, the published price that we hear about, is not what most students pay. About two-thirds of full-time students get some sort of grant aid to help them pay the price, and the net price, the amount that students actually pay, taking away the grant aid and so on, has not been rising nearly as rapidly as those published prices.
What do you think, Andrew Gillen? Is there a lot of wiggle room or a little wiggle room among higher education to lower that basic sticker price?
I think there's a lot of room. So there's a University of California professor who calculated the cost, and there's other valid costs, of course, but he calculated just the cost of putting a professor in front of the classroom. And he calculated the actual spending, not kind of some hypothetical idealized spending, and was $1,500 per student. And yet we're asking the students to pay multiples of that. The states themselves, except for New Hampshire, are paying multiples of that. So the question really becomes, where is all this money going if it's not to put a professor in front of the students? And kind of the answer to that question is that we basically reward colleges for spending money in this country, so they go out and they spend money.
What do you mean by that? Give us a little bit more, Andrew. Reward them for spending money.
Well, so we don't have a good measure of the quality of college. Like, we don't know if, you know, a Harvard graduate is better than a Princeton graduate, or an Ohio State graduate is better than a West Virginia State graduate. So because we don't have a measure of quality, they have to compete based on reputation. And the one way to increase your reputation is to spend more money, because if you spend more money, you can recruit better students, you can recruit better faculty, build better facilities. You can do all these great things that make a better school. The only problem is all those things cost a lot of money. So the schools are basically in a never-ending race to spend more money.
The academic arms race, I think, is what you've called it, Andrew. And I want to go to our callers, but Sandy Baum, real quick to you, you do hear this critique, you know, fancy sports facilities, gourmet dining halls, all in the attempt to attract more students. What do you think?
Well, if you look at how much public colleges spend to educate students, that amount has not gone up much faster than the rate of inflation in recent years. Public colleges are not spending more and more every year to educate students. They're cutting lots of things. They're hiring part-time faculty. They're cutting class sections. They're doing a lot. So for them, what's going on in recent years is not, you know, a spending feast. It is simply replacing public revenues with tuition revenues. Private research universities are spending more and more every year to educate students.
We've got lots of calls and lots more to talk about. But let's go to our listeners, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We want your perspective today on the exchange on student debt, why it's so high, especially here in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to George in Winchester first. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead, George. You're on the air.
Yes. I have a historical perspective on college. I went to UMass 71 to 73, and I had a summer job during those years. And I was making like $250 an hour, 40-hour week. And I was easily able to pay for my college education without loans or scholarships. And I feel so sorry for the students nowadays. Like my son, for instance, got out of school like 10 years ago and had $60,000 over his head.
Wow. Wow, that's a lot. So what do you think the answer is, George?
I'm wondering why. The answer is, why was it okay then and not now? What happened? What changed?
What's changed? Right. Good point. And Tara, do you want to jump in on this? And then I'll turn to our other guests as well.
Well, George, you know, I think it's really difficult for any student to be able to earn $25,000 to cover the cost of tuition and fees at a University of New Hampshire, for example. To manage to do that in today's situation, this is very, very difficult. I think that families, you know, would love to be able to pay as they go. You know, they would love to be able to use current income to manage college costs, but I just don't think that it's realistic. Even our community colleges here in New Hampshire, you know, while they're a fantastic value for New Hampshire students, there's no doubt about that, they're still among the most expensive community colleges in the country. And so, you know, at $6,500, $6,000 for the year, that's still somewhat difficult to be going to school full time and working part time and managing those costs. So even at the, you know, the community college level where a lot of students get a strong foundation and then move on, it still can be a burden. So I just think, you know, unfortunately, times have changed. I know my own father's always sharing the stories of his own ability to manage college costs and how he just can't believe it, and he doesn't know how, you know, any of us will do it, you know, for our children.
Right. And we're all kind of looking at that. And Andrew Gillen, to you, you know, we talked earlier about college spending, and you said colleges need to look at their spending habits. But what about student expectations? For example, any college worth its salt these days has to provide internet access for everybody. There are certain expectations and requirements that students demand colleges provide today, and those are expensive.
Yeah. So there's definitely kind of a amenities aspect to it. But the other argument here is that we don't charge the students for those extra amenities. So they pay an upfront fee, and then they want to demand as much as possible, which makes sense. But if they had to pay for each of those different services, maybe there wouldn't be as much demand for them if they had to pay for them separately rather than bundled as an entire package.
And what do you mean? Can you give us an example there?
So if you separate out, say, the gyms and all the various other services that colleges provide, sort of like they already do with dining halls,
mm-hmm.
You don't see unlimited demand for dining halls because they make you pay for it. It's not kind of taken care of within the broader bundle of tuition.
So kind of looking at it like your cable package, right? You can get the full service or, you know, just the HBO or whatever.
Right, right.
What do you think, Tara? There is a college here in New Hampshire, a couple colleges, I think, that are looking at this idea of, all right, you don't have to buy the whole kahuna. You can kind of pick and choose.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Southern New Hampshire University of Manchester is a great example of a campus that I think is adapting to the way that people want to access higher education. Granite State College is a public campus that I think is also doing a nice job of that. Essentially, what campuses are trying to do is come up with a solution for those students who want to access higher education, but don't want to live on campus or can't afford to live on campus. The amenities don't mean as much to them. What really means a lot to them is the credential, is the ability to take those courses, increase their knowledge base, and then have a credential so that they can go back out into the workforce and be able to use that credential to improve their lives and the lives of their families.
Sandy, I know you've written and thought a lot about this. I'd love your thoughts here, and then we'll go to another caller.
Well, we have a wide variety of colleges and universities in this country. So there are colleges that are very expensive, have beautiful facilities, everything you could imagine. There are very streamlined institutions that don't have dormitories, that don't hire, tenured professors. There is really a lot of variety. Every college can't offer every possible option. So there are lots of choices in that way available to students. One thing that's really important to note is that it's not just that college has gotten more expensive, which it has, but it's also that earnings haven't been growing rapidly. So if you look at what's happened to the minimum wage or to the wages of low-level jobs since the caller was in college, if the earnings would grow fast, it would be easier for students to pay their way through college as well.
It wouldn't be such a big deal. What do you think, though, Sandy, about the expectations game? Again, some point the finger at colleges and say, you need to lower the cost, but some say, students need to lower their expectations. Maybe your gym isn't state-of-the-art. Maybe, maybe your dining hall doesn't have gourmet food. You know what I'm saying? The students have high expectations these days, too.
Students do have high expectations, but again, just as there's a wide variety among institutions, there's wide variety among students. And there are some students who really want to pay for those things and others who either don't want to or can't pay for those things. It's a little problematic within an institution to have students pay individually for all of these things, because what you're going to get is that lower income students aren't going to be able to have access to the same amenities as other students on their campus. That's pretty complicated. We do have a very stratified higher education system, and low-income students tend to go to community colleges, and more affluent students tend to go to more expensive institutions, flagship publics and elite privates. And we certainly haven't solved that problem. That's a huge problem within our society, not just specific to higher education.
Our number here on The Exchange, again, is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us a short email, too, if you'd like. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Give us your thoughts on college debt, why it's so high, and what might be done to reduce those debt levels. 1-800-892-6477. I want to bring another voice into our conversation now. Joining us from Keene is Matt Norton, and he just graduated from Keene State College on Saturday. Matt, congratulations, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, how hard was it, Matt, for you to afford a college education?
Really, it was almost impossible. I couldn't do it alone. If it wasn't for the government student loans, I wouldn't have been able to attend college.
Wow. And how much did you get in overall loans, Matt?
I completed with the maximum amount of student loan debt, which is $31,000.
So that's your debt upon graduation?
Yes.
Makes the congratulations a sort of small C congratulations, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you were able to go, though, with all federal loans. You didn't have to go to private loans, which can be more expensive.
Yes. When I came here freshman year, I took a year off and actually moved to New Hampshire to establish residency, so I would have the in-state tuition. And when I did that, I applied for the financial aid under myself and with my mother's data, and all of the loans that I were offered were through government loans and Pell Grants. So, likely not the loans, but Pell Grants will also help me attend college.
Did you work during school, Matt?
I worked junior, senior year, but freshman, sophomore year, I didn't work. I needed to really figure out what I was doing in college.
Right, I understand. And I understand you also have a job lined up after school, which is good for you.
Yes. I actually have a job with Turner Construction as a safety engineer.
What about your friends, Matt? Are they also facing lots of debt like you are upon graduation?
Yes. A lot of my friends don't have jobs either. I was fortunate enough to the first semester of my senior year to start looking for jobs. I had interviews over winter break. So I knew that I needed to pay back loans because nobody else was really going to assist me in doing this. So I jumped on the ball early to really get a job and be able to pay them back in a timely manner. And a lot of my friends are struggling. Now they're graduating, loan repayments are in 6 months, and they are going to be struggling to find a job and pay back their student loans.
So what sorts of choices do you see your college friends making, Matt, because of that debt hanging over their heads?
I see them grabbing any job that they can get to pay back the minimum payment on their loan. If you don't mind me getting into a little figures, I'll be graduating with $31,000 in debt, and I'm going to consolidate all my loans since they all are direct loans from the government. So when I consolidate, it will actually take all the interest rates that I have, which range from 3.4 to 6.8, and give me an average interest rate. And from there, if I pay the maximum amount every month, which is about $230. I will be spend $51,000, or I think it's $51,000 to $54,000 by the time I'm done in 10 years. Now, for students that are graduating the same amount of debt and don't have a great position like I have,
right,
they're going to probably be paying the minimum amount, which will increase the amount that they'll be paying over 10 years by $10,000.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. So you're paying the maximum amount right up front, even though here you are just starting out in the job market. If you start out paying the minimum amount because you don't have a good job lined up, you pay for it later.
Yes.
In a big way, it sounds like.
Yes, it is.
What do you think, Matt, as we look at solutions to reducing this debt burden for students, especially students in New Hampshire, what do you think some of the answers are?
What I really believe is what Adam was saying earlier, is to really, or I believe it was Adam, to really focus on financials when you're in high school, or maybe it's Tara. Because when I was in college, I didn't really think about my loan, all the loans that I had. It was pretty much like a month before I graduated, all right, now I have to start thinking about my loan. But if I were to really even just focus on the interest and pay, like I heard this like saying that if you put $2 in a jar a day, that you can pay off your interest that is going to accrue from your unsubsidized loans by the time you graduate. So you can graduate with $1,500 less in interest repayment. You know what I mean?
Well, Matt, it's been good to talk to you, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Again, that's Matt Norton. He just graduated from Keene State College this weekend. And Tara Payne, he's got a job lined up. It sounds like he's got that financial literacy that you talked about earlier.
He's a college grad rock star, that guy. Let me tell you. You know, I mean, to know exactly what the loan is ultimately going to cost him by the time he's finished, to understand what the monthly payments are, to understand that he has the option to consolidate that debt, to take a look at what his skills will yield in the marketplace, and to look at an occupation that's going to help him support his obligation. Phenomenal.
Well, here's an email from Carrie who says, regarding financial aid, I have two kids, one graduating from college next week. Congratulations, Carrie. And one entering college in September. She says, when you receive the financial aid decisions from the colleges, it shows scholarships, grants, Stafford loans. It then shows the amount of tuition for the family. You have to go to the Stafford link to get specifics on what the loan rate or other information is about the loan. If you don't follow the link and just look at the immediate total, it looks good, and it makes it easier to overlook the long-term cost of the loan or how the loan works. What do you think, Tara?
Yeah, it's true. You know, there's a lot of work happening right now from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to help families understand, you know before you owe is their little tagline. And I think that that's very important. You know, one of the things that, President Obama making college a priority has definitely increased transparency, and I think that will only increase as we continue.
All right. And when we come back, we'll take a lot more of your calls and emails, so stay on the line. 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
Nowadays, science and religion do daily battle.
The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown blew that battleground wide open.
Both vying to be that infallible source from which we draw our truth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join Dan and me at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on May 18th. Tickets and information for this special benefit for writers on the New England stage are at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from People's United Bank, providing individual mortgage solutions for new and existing mortgages. People's United Bank, what know-how can do. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're tackling the issue of steep student debt and exploring possible solutions. Join us with your questions and comments. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also join us on our Facebook page. And let's go right back to the callers, all of you. And Mark's waiting in Peterborough. Hi, Mark. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your last email was speaking to what I was thinking about. I graduated on the 18th. I went back to school in 2009, losing my job then. And student loan, federal student loans, was going to be the only way I went. And I felt I was able to get loans and feel good about being able to pay them back. But in all the talk recently of low rates, I looked at what my rates are, and they're all right around 8%. And what I realized that I didn't pay a lot of attention to was the types of loans that the government offers.
And I see.
I wondered if your guest could speak a little bit to the varieties and or what I might be looking at down the road besides consolidation to perhaps get lower rates. Because 8% right now, I'm still okay with it because I think in the long run it's going to serve me for what I've gotten from school. But 8% is 8% right now, and that's high.
Right. And when we hear that other student loan rates are 3.4%, you think, okay, 8% is a lot. Andrew Gillen, let's hear from you on that.
So the rates on the Stafford loans are definitely going to be much lower, and there's two different kinds of those, subsidized and unsubsidized. Once you get beyond the Stafford loans, you start getting into kind of the Parent Plus and the Grad Plus loans, and those all carry higher interest rates.
I see.
So you definitely want to take out Stafford loans before taking out the other types.
If they're available. So not all federal loans are that nice low Stafford loan rate. There are other things. I see, Andrew. And how much do you think, Tara, people are aware of that? They hear federal loans, great, guaranteed, nice and low.
Yeah, and you know, I think when it comes to students generally, that is going to be your best bargain, because who else is going to give $5,000 to a person with no credit history
and no job.
So, you know, definitely for students, I think it makes a lot of sense. But it does raise a good point for grad students, and I think for parents. You know, the federal government right now is charging 7.9% to take out these loans, and for some parents who may have equity in their home or who may have other financing options, you know, you could be looking at rates of 4 or 5%. So in general, when we talk to students, the Stafford loan, the federal loan, is going to be their best bargain.
But does
when
that cover everything, though?
It doesn't sometimes.
So then
some
what
of
do you do?
Students. Well, you know, I tend to agree that if they need more than what the federal government is able to provide, then they probably should consider another alternative.
You know, it's interesting. And to you, Sandy Baum, we heard earlier from Matt Norton, who just graduated from Keene State College, and he mentioned the federal loans. But he said he also got Pell Grants. It's my understanding, Sandy, that the grants aren't what they used to be. That's what you want. It's free money, but there isn't that much around. Is that right?
Well, actually, in the case of federal grants, that's not true at all. The federal government is spending twice as much on Pell Grants as it did just a couple of years ago.
Really? Okay.
Pell Grants have actually risen quite a bit. Not every student can get one, but about a third of undergraduate students are now getting Pell Grants. But one thing that's very important that we haven't discussed is that for federal student loans, there is a very important income-based repayment plan. So if you have federal student loans and you don't have a job, or you have a job but your income is below 150% of the poverty line, you don't actually have to make payments. And then when you do make payments, it's only an affordable percentage of your income. Many students don't know about this income-based repayment plan, but it's very important in terms of keeping loan payments affordable. So federal loans only, not private loans, but federal student loans, if you can't afford it, you don't actually have to pay until you can afford it. So that's very important. And the other thing is that the conversation in the news suggests that all student loans have a 3.4% interest rate and it's about to double. That's just not true at all. It's a very small subset of federal student loans that now, and only ones that were issued last year, have 3.4% interest. And if this passes Congress, that means that next year, for 1 year, a subset of students will be able to get some of their loans at 3.4%. So it is much more complicated than it sounds.
Yeah, as our caller points out, he had all student loans, but he realized they weren't that super low rate. You know, you mentioned the federal loans, Sandy, having sort of a graduated scale of repayment, depending on how you're doing financially. But do you ultimately have to pay these back? I mean, if you declare bankruptcy, do your student loans get wiped out as well?
Student loans, federal and private student loans, are not dischargeable in bankruptcy except under extraordinary circumstances. However, for federal student loans, if you're in this income-based repayment plan, if after 25 years, soon to become 20 years, you haven't been able to afford to repay, then your loans will be forgiven. So there is no bankruptcy provision, but eventually your federal student loans will be forgiven if your income is not high enough to support them.
Let's take another call if we could. And this is James in Waterville Valley. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Basically, I've had three children in college. Two of them have completed. One of them's graduating next week and next 2 weeks. But what I'm interested in is I noticed in recently the community college system that's done a heroic job over the last number of decades has been unable to meet all of the needs, and a huge volume of for-profit colleges has come online that have actually marketed their services. Many children are and adults are accessing that and borrowing huge amounts of money. And I'm concerned if, in fact, many of these are legitimately leading to earnings that will repay the amount of debt that's being incurred by these schools. And I don't think they're a small part of the market. I think some of these schools are multiples of the largest universities we've had. There has to be a scrutinizing eye turned towards institutions that are receiving huge amounts of federal and private loans to ensure that they're not simply swallowing the money and leaving students without the ability to graduate.
Yeah, it reminds me of the accountability debate at the
unable to be employed. This is what I'm concerned about, and you can it could follow to your death. And if these students aren't able to perform, then it probably will, but it will. They'll never be repaid. So
well, James, let me see what our guests think about this, and I've definitely heard about this in the news. And Andrew Gillen, to you first, I have heard about this. What kind of schools are we talking about exactly, though? I mean, obviously not state schools, not private, nonprofit schools. What are these private institutions that have come under criticism recently?
So there's been a big push back against the for-profits. Now most of them are going to be in the four-year, so they're issuing bachelor's degrees, but they do compete a lot with community colleges as well. So they're serving typically underserved populations. And one of the criticisms is that their graduation rates are very low. So a lot of students are leaving school without a degree, but they still have this high debt.
Mm.
And that's a concern in every sector of higher ed. But it's a particular concern for the for-profit sector because they don't have the public subsidies that help to keep the price down.
So, Sandy, again, just to clarify. So George Washington, it's not a state school, but it's a private nonprofit. So we're not talking about George Washington. We're not talking about Harvard. We're not talking about Dartmouth, even though those aren't state schools. Is that correct? I just want to get a handle on exactly what we're talking about here.
Historically, most of the name brand schools that people think of are private, nonprofit. Nobody's making a profit from them.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody owns them. The for-profit institutions, the University of Phoenix is the largest. People have heard of the University of Phoenix, Kaplan, Strayer. There are some big ones, many of them publicly held. There are also a lot of small for-profit institutions that are just, you know, small. They may teach some particular vocational track. Some of these institutions do a very good job, but many of them are spending a lot of money on recruiting, have very high profits, pay very high salaries. They advertise a lot, and students who are having trouble getting the classes they need at community colleges are particularly vulnerable to going to these institutions, paying much, much higher tuition than they would pay in the public sector, and signing on the dotted line for loans that they don't understand.
Tara, do we have this issue in New Hampshire?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly there are some institutions that I think are not working in the best interests of the students that they serve. That's true. But I think part of this criticism comes more for those that are the non-degree granting institutions who maybe are charging tuition and fees. But they do serve a purpose, though, because for some students who desire some education beyond high school but not a degree, then I think those career schools are able to play a role. You know, and it comes down to education. What are you getting for what you pay? So it's not saying that they're all lousy or making generalized statements about for-profit institutions. I think it comes down to educating families about what they're getting for what they pay.
Let's take another call. Thanks for that one. And this is Ivan in Ware. Hi, Ivan. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. How are you doing? Thank you. One thing I disagree with that I hear you guys saying a lot is the idea that poor kids, I assume, should lower their expectations because obviously they don't have the money to be, you know, to do great things. My daughter would never be a doctor today if we listened to that kind of talk. And but I think what we should do is reward, find a way to reward ability and passion and hunger. Because, you know, kids who are poor actually have more hunger to achieve great things, to strive. And otherwise, you know, only rich kids would be doctors and scientists and lawyers and that kind of thing. Because poor kids obviously don't have, you know, the means going in to achieve these things. So I don't think the idea is for kids to lower their expectations. I think we need to keep their dreams alive and find ways to help them achieve that, achieve those things.
You know, Ivan, this is a really important point. And Sandy Baum, we're not talking about, you know, who's got the nicest jeans or sneakers. We're talking about education.
I don't think any of us intended to say what the caller heard. We would all agree that, of course, low-income students should have the same opportunities as other people, and that people should, I mean, if somebody has the capability and the interest and the motivation to go to college, to be a professional, of course they should do those things. The problem is it's not just about low-income students. I mean, in fact, many low-income students have access to financial aid that maybe some other students don't have. If you could get into an elite private college, if you're a low-income student, it's going to be free. And you should certainly look at those opportunities, not limit yourself to the institutions that have low price tags. The problem is that there are many students, not just low-income students, middle-income students, who are borrowing a lot because they think, I want to go to that college and study this thing, and I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life, and I could go to a college that would do just as well for me but would be cheaper, and everyone has to take that into consideration. So absolutely, we need more support for lower and moderate income students, but they also need a lot of good information because many of them are making choices that they think will help them follow their dreams but actually won't.
Well, Ivan, thanks for the call. Andrew Gillen, your thoughts real quick?
Yeah, I just agree with what Sandy said there.
You'd agree with what Sandy said there. Okay. And let's go next to Sarah in Bow. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you to the panel for taking the time this morning. I'm in my late 20s. I have a bachelor's degree, and I've put it to good use, and I'm very fortunate that I was brought up with smart financial planning as part of my background. And yet all of my friends, you know, that we're at these turning points in our lives, we're getting married, we're planning on having children. A lot of us are putting off our future plans because our debt has been, you know, to such extensive levels. And I'm not entirely sure that your panel will be able to speak to this, but I just sort of wanted to raise that question of, you know, so many of us do actually stay, work, play here, went to school here, made New Hampshire our homes and want to raise our families here. But, you know, with all of this debt, how can we easily contribute to, you know, the New Hampshire economy, which almost feels like a phenomena in itself because our housing market, the prices have sort of stayed higher comparable to other places in the country. And as one of your panelists said, we don't subsidize our education as much as other states do. So if you guys could sort of just speak on that, I'm sure a lot of folks my age would appreciate your insight.
Yeah, Sarah, absolutely. And thank you so much. And this whole idea, Tara, that I have read about, it's delayed adulthood almost. You can't buy that house. You can't start that family just yet because you're so burdened by these loans.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is a reality. I would say that I hope we can turn like we do in so many other ways in New Hampshire to the private sector to help us with that. You know, maybe that's the new benefit that employers offer is student loan repayment assistance. You know, in New Hampshire, we often talk that organizations like the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation do such a phenomenal job and help make up the gap where state support ends. New Hampshire Charitable Foundation is there, thankfully. You know, is it the same with our local employers? Is there going to be a way that that becomes the new benefit is student debt repayment assistance? I do just want to mention one thing to piggyback on a point that was made earlier, though, regarding student loan repayment and forgiveness and repayment options. And I just want to encourage students who are having a difficult time with their student loan repayment, keep in contact with the person who holds your loan. Please do not assume that there will be a forgiveness program out there. I think that young adults like Sarah, they need to enter into this commitment and this obligation knowing that they will likely have to delay that home, maybe move to a different area where there are more jobs, maybe think more about what other expenditures they have and then other ways that they consume. It's very important to go into it with eyes wide open, and Sarah makes a fantastic point.
Yeah, Sarah, thanks a lot for calling. And just to wrap up with all of you, what do you think, Andrew Gillen? You know, are we going to figure this out in the next 5 or 10 years, or are we still going to be talking about this 10 years from now?
I think we will. So even the students who don't borrow too much to put themselves in kind of permanent financial purgatory, even so, there's that category, the disaster cases. And then there's also a ton of people like Sarah. And we're kind of reaching the point where there's enough awareness about the problems that this is causing that I think the chances of seeing a solution are pretty good.
Sandy, what do you think? Tara and I were talking before the show started. We both have children ages somewhere between 6 and 12. Will this be solved in the next 5 or 10 years? What do you think?
Well, it won't be solved in the sense that if we're going to have quality higher education, someone has to pay for it. And it's either going to be through the taxpayers or through the students and families. But one thing that I think is very important is to compare your situation not to what your life would be like if you had gone to college and didn't have debt, but if you had chosen instead not to go to college, what would your standard of living look like?
All right. Well, Sandy Baum, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sandy Baum, economist and senior fellow at the George Washington University Graduate School of Education. Andrew Gillen, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Gillen, senior researcher for the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, a nonprofit organization based in D.C. And Tara Payne, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tara Payne, she's vice president of college planning and community engagement for the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Canoy.